B2. Number 24A.
And as you do that, and as we did that a few years ago, suddenly something broke on our consciousness and we said, that's not enough. There is still a flaw in it. There is still something in it which is not yet purely spiritual. And so we came to the sixth step, namely to absolute Christian Science, where we began to realize something higher. Because in the fifth, you remember we have said, I have no other mind but that mind which is God. And so we began to ask ourselves, what did we mean with that I? I have no other mind but that mind which is God. What is that I? What did I mean with that I? And we still felt, oh, there was still something impure there. We still felt that I is me. And we were talking about, there is no other, I have no other mind but that mind which is God. Or mind which is God is my mind. What did we mean with my? Because in absolute Christian Science she says, mine and thine are obsolete terms. So we had to go further in consciousness and even drop the I in it, where we said, I have the mind, the same mind as God, and substitute that I with the divine I, which Mrs. Eddy said is life, truth and love. And so instead of saying that I have no other mind but that which is God, I can now see life, truth and love, the I, has no other mind but that which is God. The I, life, truth and love, is the mind of man. Life, truth and love is the spirit of man. Can you see? That life, truth and love is the soul of man. That life, truth and love is really my principle. That life, truth and love is my life. That life, truth and love is my truth. These are things, you know, they become so wonderful, so powerful, so impersonal when one goes over that over hours and hours, day after day, day after day. The trouble usually is that we are willing to learn piano and are willing to exercise and exercise always the same finger exercises over months and months and months and don't feel that this is extraordinary, that this is burdensome. But when it comes to spiritual culture, we always feel that if we say a sentence, that's enough. That's the letter. We seem not to be willing, really, to sit down and take those most fundamental visions and just elaborate on them through the seven synonymous terms, over, 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 until they are consciousness. Here it is so much different. If I say, I have no other mind but that mind which is God, or if I say, life, truth and love is my mind. When I say life, truth and love is my mind, then I know that the person of God, or the life, truth and love which is God itself, is conscious of me as mind. It is my mind. Life, truth and love is operating as my mind. Life, truth and love is operating as my spirit. Life, truth and love is operating as my soul, as my principle, as my life, truth and love. So, can you see how in this way we get nearer and nearer to the one being, or further and further away from the personal I, and therefore from the letter? And so we come to the seventh point, where we see that the synonyms of God are the only I or ego, where we begin to realize that in the six, we still had some sort of duality. In the sixth we still had that first the mind of life, truth and love, which is my mind, as if there were still two aspects of that mind. And so finally I just can lift it up to the point where I can see there is but one I or ego, there is just but one mind, one spirit. And I sit back and I don't think about identifying myself with mind. I don't see that that is my mind. It's just the one ego, the one I. I just sit back and see that the synonym of God is the only I. Therefore that mind is the I. And that spirit is the I. That soul is the I. Principle, life, truth and love is the I or ego. What another sense that I see when that these seven synonymous terms are ego and are therefore the only ego. It's no more my ego, it's just ego or the only I, the only ego. And so we come really to the climax in the eighth, where I see that that ego is. That that I is. And that is called I am. So that the seventh, which has brought us to the statement that there is but one I, now I begin to realize that that one I is the I am. I am. Just the I am. And so, can you see, we arrive at that which is the comprehensive point of view. But it is a spiritual ladder. Can you say a ladder? With spiritual steps. And as we culture each step one by one, we really feel we are brought step by step nearer and nearer into one, into the one being. I want to stress with that, that we have somehow to see this line because it leads us out of metaphysics. That eternal question which we hear, how should I think, you see, is on such a low plane. It is that second stage or third stage, really. How should I think? How should I think that I think right? This is only the third. And people think this is the climax of Christian Science. That thinking right is the thing which Mrs. Eddy presented. It isn't at all. Mrs. Eddy didn't present a thought system. She presented the science of mind and not of thinking. She didn't present a science of thinking, nor a system of thinking. But she led up thought to the point where thought loses itself, is discarded, is obsolete, and the divine mind takes slowly over with science, and taking over it unfolds and unfolds until consciousness is just imbued by the one thing, I am. And then we understand why Mrs. Eddy says, just accept for yourself the fact that I am is the law in its own creation. That I am is the law of every experience and of any experience. It's the I am. Now the I am is not an I am because I think it, nor does the I am think. Science is far above the metaphysical level, far above the thinking level. Naturally, the moment we touch the infinite, we have seen this morning, the infinite touches us. And therefore, this consciousness has a descending way, and that descending way I tried to show on the second part of this chart, where the I am, see, comes down to the deepest level as the I am. Down to the deep, it never loses its I am-ness. even if it comes down to deeper dimensions and lower dimensions, the I am never loses its integrity, the I am-ness. But it comes to every plane of thought. And so we can see the eighth, which says, I am what I am, translates itself now again to the seventh stage, namely where it says, I am is the I am of all, it's of everything. You remember, if you would combine it with the four levels, you have the eighth, seventh, sixth, and fifth, always as the four levels, just as you had it in the ascending sense, the four levels. And so, in the descending way, we can see that the I am is the I am, and is therefore the I am of everything, of all, of everything. And therefore it is the I am in the sixth of every individualized situation. So the sixth shows that this I am is infinitely individualized as individual I ams. As individual I ams, as infinitely individualized I ams. I just feel that the big I am, the being of being, is individualized in being small b. And naturally, we begin to see that this, in the fifth point, that this I am has no other I am, has no personal I. And therefore comes to us further down as that I am which is thinking us. It's no more we thinking about mind. Now the divine mind is God and his thoughts. See, God and his thoughts is not a very high statement. God and his thoughts is a metaphysical statement because God doesn't think. So it isn't the thoughts of God. It's God and how he translates itself to us as God-like thoughts. And so we see what is meant when we see that we have God-like thoughts. It comes to us as thinking us. And this I am gives us ideas. You see, in the third, in the ascending, we had ideas. Now this God and his thoughts comes to us and gives us the right ideas. To us, to our thinking. And giving us the right ideas, naturally on the level of the two, it shows that this gives us only good thoughts. Now we begin to value our ideas as good and not evil. And see that all that comes from God are God's thoughts, that God's thoughts are ideas, and that these ideas are good. And then lastly, on point one, that this I am makes us to be the thought of. That which is thought of. Not that who thinks about. Can you see what I mean with the thought of? We are thought by God. We are not thinking of God. We are not trying to see something mentally. We are being mentalized by God. And therefore we are. See, there we don't say anymore cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. At that point it is just the other way around. It is cogitor, which is the passive form. Cogitor ergo sum. Because God perceives me, I am. Because God thinks me, I am. I'm the thought of God. And this naturally, we have not enough time for all that. This naturally would lead thought to see, that all that has ever been thought positively and progressively in human history was not the merit of people like Plato, Socrates, or Thales of Miletus, or so, or Einstein, but that it is the merit of the divine mind thinking Plato, thinking Socrates, thinking Einstein. And if it wouldn't be Einstein that would be transparent for it, that divine mind would have fetched out another one to think that way. We are the thought of God. There is nothing personalized about the new idea, like the theory of relativity. We say it's Einstein's theory of relativity, but it isn't. It is the divine mind's presentation to human thought of something new. And funnily enough, this is not only what we see and what really Kimball, as the first one, began to teach, but it is today recognized in the world. I just read recently a very interesting book about the Great Transformation. It's called The Great Transformation, in which they showed that every discovery which has been made in technology or anything has a metaphysical background, that it is an idea which has always existed and which just has been waiting for the right time and for the right moment to push through, and therefore chooses that situation where it is most transparent and shines through. It isn't some very intelligent guy who discovers an idea, who constructs something new. It is the divine idea who uses that situation which is transparent for the development of the idea. Because the idea is much bigger than people. The divine mind is much bigger than thinking. And therefore, like the philosopher, the present-day philosopher Heidegger, he says, these people like Plato and so on have been thinking certain things. And ask himself, why has he been thinking that and not something else? What made him think exactly what he was thinking and not something else? And he says, because he had to think what he was thinking. He was not free. People are not free if they are thinking progressively to think what they want to think. The divine idea thinks what it brings a thought to people and makes them think what brings humanity further and further, higher and higher, and brings them forward. Because evolution has gone on before there were thinking people. Before there were men on earth, there was evolution. And therefore evolution has an idea, has an intelligence, which is independent on man and his brain and his thinking. And so let's stop that thing that we think that we can reach being by thinking. Let's much more be willing to let the divine mind think us and see that the divine mind is always knowing itself, is always saying I am, and therefore is always the law in his creation. So that divine mind, as the I am, is always the law of our thoughts. So, can you see how in this way I have given you, the line in which the idea has developed within our consciousness, how through different stages of understanding and cognition and vision, we have been pushed, so to say, always to a higher level of unity with God, always to a higher. And second, what I want to impress by it is to show that this way of unfoldment is something which cannot just be read or just thought at one time, but that there are stages which have to be pondered and pondered and pondered and pondered very systematically. Very systematically. I can only assure you that those students who have done that over the last 2 or 3 years, especially from the point of science onward, point 5, 6, 7, that they have felt that a whole new life, a whole new attitude of life, a whole new sense of life has come upon them. And they didn't do a lot of study, you know, hours and hours of picking up sentences and looking up concordances and gathering together all sorts of statements, but just by finding these important steps and then stay with them over months and months and months. Just sit back and say, what does it mean? What does it mean, that fifth step, that only mind, or this is in honest terms of God in us, can be one with God? That only mind, which is God in me, knows mind, that is God. What does it mean that only spirit in me unfolds that which is spirit? That only soul in me identifies that which is the soul of God? Just go over it and see it. Naturally, we have to know the ideas, and then that helps us to drop and drop the personal I. And then to say, well, what does it mean that I have the mind which is God? What is this I? And I begin to realize, let's get rid of that I. Let's put instead of it God, the person of God, the person I, life, truth and love. And my word, the moment we begin to see and use those laws, which we'll take next week too, that life, truth and love is my mind. What that means. If you think it out, what that means. Just as I stated, they are just words, a few synonymous terms put together in a certain way. But what does it mean in spiritual culture, in spiritual being, to see that the only mind that is going on and that is moving and moving and doing something and thinking something is the mind of life, truth and love. Life, truth and love, which we have seen, that eternal impulsion of life which says, I express myself as the truth of everything in its completeness. That is creator of my thinking, the creator of my mind. That fills my mind with mind, and so on. All right. We have seen how, in the line of spiritual evolution, really, we usually begin by seeing that everything is mental, and that we can bring back the material universe to mentality, and that everything depends on our mentality. Now, this was the point which, at the beginning of Mr. Zeddy's teaching, was more or less the focus of her students. She had to show them that all is mental, and that the mental rules the physical or the material, and that's how far she could go at the initial stage. And this naturally brought that second step which we have seen, namely the question, is the mental good or evil? If the mental is good, it has good effects. If the mentality is evil, it has destructive, evil effects. And this is the point at which Mrs. Eddy had to take up the subject of animal magnetism. Because at the beginning of her discovery in 1866, up to 1875, for more or less 9 years, she was unaware of this whole question of having a bad mentality. To her, the revelation that mind is all and matter nothing, and that this mind is good, was so clear and so powerful and so natural that she never thought that mind brought down to the level of mentality could be misused. And so only after 9 years she began to realize that she had to investigate a phenomena of which she was not aware of. We know how she wrote Science and Health, how she sent the manuscript to the printer, how the printer suddenly didn't send any more of the proofs, and she didn't hear anything anymore, and that she decided at that point to write some additional pages on animal magnetism. And with this new additional manuscript under her arm, she went to the station, and on the way to the station she met the printer, who brought her, after a long period, again some of the page proofs, the galleys or whatever we call them. And she writes about that incident in retrospection and shows how she had a reluctance up to that point to introduce the subject of animal magnetism to the public, but that at that time she felt impelled to bring it to the open. In miscellaneous writings she makes in this connection this enormous statement: "I shall not forget the cost of investigating for this age, the method and power of error. While the ways, means and potency of truth had flowed into my consciousness as easily as dawns the morning light and shadows flee, the metaphysical mystery of error." It is a metaphysical mystery, not the scientific mystery. "The metaphysical mystery of error, its hidden paths, purpose and fruits, at first defied me." It defied her. "I was saying all the time, come not thou into the secret, but at length took up the research according to God's demand." And so she took up the research of that big question. And what I will do now is to show you how step by step she investigated this metaphysical mystery of error, and how step by step she lifted that whole proposition of error or animal magnetism out of the mental, out of the metaphysical, into the realm of science. And that only then, when she lifted it out of the metaphysical realm into the realm of science, that only then she really found peace and really found an answer. So I want to go with you through this development, and I do it by taking her own words, by taking the various revisions of Science and Health. I have taken every revision, every main revision of Science and Health, and have read all what she was saying about animal magnetism and the chapter on animal magnetism, and have compared what she has changed from one revision to the other. And really, if one takes the first statement of animal magnetism in the first edition and compares it with the chapter on animal magnetism in the last edition, there is practically not one sentence alike. One could hardly recognize anymore that it is the same subject, which shows that in her thought that subject of animal magnetism developed step by step. It wasn't clear right from the beginning. She said at first it defied me, and then she had to pay the cost of investigation. Step by step she experienced, she experimented with animal magnetism and came always to newer and newer conclusions, and in every new revision of Science and Health she would give the new insight she has won. So it is shown that through these editions we have seen 7 main alterations on this subject of animal magnetism. The first statement she gives is in the first edition of 1875. You have it here on the chart, and it has a tone of mind. It is as if she would deal with the whole subject only from the point of view of mind. She gave the explanation of animal magnetism not as a special chapter, but the subject was treated at the beginning of the chapter Healing the Sick, and it contained around about 16 pages. I say every time how many pages, because alone the amount of pages she has written on the subject will give us quite an indication of her ups and downs in the research. What does she say in the first chapter? And so I just quickly recapitulize in a few minutes what she has written in those 16 pages. It's all from the point of view of mind, from the point of view of observation.